We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Okay. Crazy week. And starting out with local and Isolde Raftery at KOW did a critical piece this week about
Yes, KUOW has done an investigation, and they've dug into all of the documentation they could find around the abandonment of the East Police Precinct on Capitol Hill last June, and they laid out a timeline and revealed who they think is responsible for the abandonment of the East Precinct last June. And not to keep people in suspense, they point to Assistant Chief Tom Mahaffey, who was the incident commander for the protests, and his deputy captain, Kevin Grossman. And apparently those two didn't tell Chief Best or Mayor Durkin on purpose that they were planning kind of parallel to the mayor and the police chief's planning to pull officers out of the precinct. So other things that we learned from reading the KUOW investigation is that on June 8th, current interim chief Adrian Diaz, who was an assistant chief at that time, urged Mayor Durkin and Chief Best to let him identify a number of officers to engage in a dialogue with the protesters. Mahaffey and his deputies disagreed and shot down that idea, which might have avoided all of this stuff to begin with, right? Also learned that staffers in the mayor's office, including Deputy Mayor Casey Sixkiller, who's currently running for mayor, right, told Chief Best, Assistant Chief Mahaffey, and the other assistant chiefs that Durkin could be ousted at any time by the city council, at which point Council President Lorena Gonzalez would then become interim mayor. And then, according to Sixkiller, look out, because she and the city council are devils out to destroy the police department. So no pressure, right?
Yeah, and no mischaracterization at all.
Right, right. And then Chief Best, we learned that on June 8th, Chief Best told Mahaffey to allow protesters to march past the precinct. That was the decision she and Durkin came to. But they were adamant that police should stay inside the precinct. Now, the assistant chiefs conferred, along with Durkin's chief of staff, Stephanie Formas, who was in the same room with them. Mahaffey, at that point, apparently is vehement that the East Precinct will not be abandoned, which means that they absolutely discussed that possibility in that meeting. And then they all apparently disperse. Then we're led to believe that Mahaffey went off with his assistant department, deputy captain, Chief Grossman, and decided, okay, let's just abandon the precinct, right? So then he then gives orders to officers at the East Precinct to start packing up while he prepares an email to go out to the rest of the Seattle police personnel saying that the decision's been made to let the protesters march past the East Precinct, but that email contained no mention of abandoning the precinct building, right? That's apparently what happened, right? Then apparently Deputy Mayor Mike Fong and Stephanie Formas hear through the grapevine that equipment is being moved out of the East Precinct building. Well, then they get into a car and go down there, and they show up just as the last equipment is being loaded into vans. And instead of ordering police back into the building, Fong and Chief Best and Stephanie Formas kind of sit back and wait, assuming that the East Precinct officers will go back inside the building the next day after the protests, after the protesters have all marched past the precinct and the protest is done, right?
But so what they're saying is that this was not well thought out.
Oh, no. And the response to it within city government was lame, right? Durkin's deputy Fong and her chief of staff Formas are just kind of standing around with their fingers up their noses going, what are you guys doing? Where are you going?
Now, I can remember last summer when we were saying that Mayor Durkan and Chief Best did not have control of the police department.
Yeah,
this
apparently
was seen
that
to back
was true.
That up. Yes.
Yeah, apparently that was true. Yeah, so while they were sitting around going, okay, the precinct officers will all come back the next day, right? Instead, the activists recognize immediately that there are no cops in the East Precinct, and they set up barricades and establish the autonomous zone within just a few hours. And of course, later that week, Chief Best learns who made the call to abandon the precinct. So she knew fairly early on who made that decision instead of telling reporters who was responsible.
So I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Why did it take 13 months for this to come out?
Apparently, Durkan and Best would be happy if it never came out.
Apparently.
Okay. Because at the time, instead of telling reporters who was responsible, Chief Best called it a command decision, in essence, backing up Mahaffey and covering for him, even though she admitted that she wasn't the one who made the call. Instead, Chief Best blames the Parks Department for letting people plant vegetables in Cal Anderson Park, and she blames the Seattle Public Utilities for putting a couple of porta potties in the park for the protesters.
Yes,
saying, oh no,
people
city's undermining.
People pooping in the park would have been so much better.
Oh yeah. No, so her response is, oh no, let's not throw Mahaffey to the wolves, right? And let's not expose the fact that she doesn't have control of her assistant chiefs, you know. Let's just blame it all on the city of Seattle, who is providing, you know, basic hygiene services to the protesters. And of course, about a month after that, Chief Best decided she was going to resign instead of taking a pay cut, right? When the city council started looking at defunding the police budget. And the city council voted to cut that budget for the first time in recent memory. By December, Mayor Durkan then announced that she would not run for re-election. So instead, now we have City Council President Lorena Gonzalez running for mayor, right? Which, of course, is why Casey Sixkiller had to throw his hat into the ring, because, of course, he views Gonzalez as a devil, right? Hoping to lock Gonzalez out of the primary, which I don't think is going to happen.
I don't think he's going to be locking anybody out of the primary.
No.
Other than himself.
No. So, and I also find it kind of suspicious that there's been no polling by the mainstream media in Seattle on which candidates are doing well in the mayor's race and which ones are not. I'm sure some of the candidates are doing their own polling, but we haven't. Typically, we would see the Seattle Times, or we'd see one of the major TV news stations doing some kind of polling to find out who's ahead and who's not. But we haven't seen any of that.
That's true.
Really suspicious. I'm thinking maybe they are doing it, they just don't want to release the results because they're scared.
Well, we did see the Seattle Times yesterday come out endorsing Bruce Harrell.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
they don't want to show polls that might lead people to believe their endorsement isn't as strong as they'd like it to be.
Yeah, or I think I wasn't surprised that they would endorse Bruce Harrell. But I think they're probably too scared to release polls that show Andrew Grant Houston doing well and Lorena Gonzalez doing well and maybe Jessen Farrell doing well, better than their preferred candidate, Bruce Harrell. Because I think everybody is assuming that Harrell, because he was on council for so long and he's the one who has the most experience of city politics, is the shoe-in. But I'm not persuaded of that at this point. And I think if he was the shoe-in, we'd see polls and we'd see more articles speculating on, okay, who's going to be running against him in November.
And I think Colleen Echohawk took a lot of his fundraising base because he got in the race relatively late.
Yeah.
And she was in early.
Yeah.
And, you know, he seems to have edged out other people who wanted business support. For instance, Casey Sixkiller, Lance Randall, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, he's gotten some late traction, And of course, he gets very large average donations, which tells you where his money is coming from. But
it doesn't tell you how popular he is. That's what
it does not tell you how popular he is. It tells you, though, how popular he is among that sector. Mm. And the answer is not very. Because the number of donations that he's getting, you would expect him to be getting far more.
Yeah, and interestingly, his PAC hasn't been getting as many donations as I expected. He hasn't. Lorena Gonzalez's PAC, which formed after his, got some big labor donations right off the bat. So she's got a lot of money behind her going into this primary. Bruce Harrell set up his PAC earlier, but has been struggling actually to get more donations. So I think that's a bad sign for him.
Yeah.
So
we can only hope.
Yeah. So also this week, the OPA, the Office of Police Accountability, issued a report this week recommending that Interim Chief Adrian Diaz fire the two Seattle police officers who were involved in the Washington, D.C. Capitol riot on January 6th, as shown in videos of the Capitol riot. Those videos show that those two officers didn't actively enter the building, but they did look on in approval as others breached the building where Congress was tallying the votes that would later confirm Joe Biden as the winner of the presidential election. The names of those two officers are Alexander Everett and Caitlin Rochelle, and they're a married couple. The OPA determined that they didn't have enough evidence to rule on a third officer who had been initially standing on the Capitol grounds with Everett and Rochelle, but he said, that officer had told the OPA that he left the area because he, quote, felt uncomfortable when activists started breaching the building. Now, the OPA called this a close call and said that they could not confirm or disprove his statement. In the process of investigating the officers, the OPA ordered those officers to turn over their cell phone calls, text messages, receipts, and other documentation of what they did on January 6th. The third officer refused to turn over anything to the OPA or the FBI, who was also investigating these same officers. Because the OPA doesn't have a subpoena power under the current SPOG contract, although they do under the 2017 law passed by the city council, it's just not, that was not included in the SPOG, in the current SPOG contract. They weren't able to determine. The OPA was not able to subpoena that information to determine if the third officer was telling the truth when he said he left the scene. Three other Seattle
police officers always tell the truth.
Right. Three other Seattle Police Department officers who didn't march from the Trump rally to the Capitol grounds were cleared by the OPA. They did turn over documentation, and the OPA was able to establish that they had receipts that put them far away from the Capitol riot at the time the building was breached. The OPA, of course, cleared them because they said that by attending the rally, the Stop the Steal rally, they were merely exercising their free speech rights. But I want to point out that the Stop the Steal rally, okay, in Washington, D.C., was meant to protest the outcome of a legal election and to support Donald Trump's attempt at a coup, okay? You can't really characterize it any other way. And that's what those officers were in D.C. for.
Yeah, okay. They spent a good chunk of their own money to support the big lie.
Yeah, the big lie, and to help Donald Trump stage a coup, essentially. So in the 6 months since the Capitol riot, the two officers who were caught on videotape, Everett and Rochelle, have been on paid administrative leave for 6 months, right? So they're not working, but they're still getting paid. The other four officers who came forward voluntarily have remained on active duty. Okay. Now, Everett and Rochelle will get a hearing sometime in the coming month, probably in August. Then Interim Chief Diaz will have 30 days from the date of that hearing to decide whether to fire those two officers or not. And Diaz may decide not to fire them. He has been pretty lenient when it comes to disciplining officers that the OPA has recommended for discipline, as they've reviewed the complaints from last year's protests. So we'll see.
Hmm. All right. Moving on. The judge upheld the renter protection law in Seattle this week?
Yeah, this week. Let's take us back to 2017. The city council passed the Fair Chance Housing Ordinance, which provides protections to certain renters in Seattle. That law prevents landlords from doing criminal background checks or asking renters about their criminal history when they apply for a housing unit. Now, in 2018, a group of landlords sued the city, saying that the new law violated their free speech rights because they couldn't ask people about their criminal histories. This week, U.S. District Judge John Kugenhauer ruled in favor of the new law, saying that the law doesn't unreasonably burden landlords' commercial free speech rights, which are different and have a different level of protections than individual free speech rights. And he also ruled that it is a reasonable measure to accomplish the city's goals, which are to prevent discrimination against people who've served their sentences and prevent discrimination against people of color who are disproportionately prosecuted in our criminal justice system. The landlords, of course, are expected to appeal. But this is good news in the first ruling on this case. And hopefully this will allow people who have been to jail or to prison and who've served their sentences and are trying to turn their lives around, this is something that will help keep them from becoming homeless. Because as we know, many, many people with criminal backgrounds are finding it very difficult to get a place to live in the city of Seattle.
All right.
So that
and that's, that's assuming they can afford it.
Yeah, assuming they can afford it. But if you can get a job, you should be able to get a place to live. You shouldn't be living on the street.
You would think, but that's a larger issue. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. Maria, you've been doing analysis of the mayoral candidates the last
week. I have. This week is the fun week. It's looking at the six main mayoral candidates' positions on police accountability, gun violence, and community-based justice. Okay. So I watched a recording of the mayoral forum on gun violence hosted by the Alliance for Gun Responsibility and Grandmothers Against Gun Violence. The media sponsor for that forum was the South Seattle Emerald, and the moderator was Marcus Harrison Green, who, for disclosure reasons, is the co-founder of the South Seattle Emerald, but who's also written for Eat the State and for the Seattle Times.
Yes, and I've written for South Seattle Emerald, and Marcus is a good friend of mine, so
yes,
full disclosure.
And I also know Marcus. Now, in attendance were Colleen Echohawk, Jessen Farrell, Lorena Gonzalez, Bruce Harrell, and Andrew Grant Houston. Casey Sixkiller was not invited because he didn't meet the criteria for selection. Candidates needed to do two things: to participate in the endorsement process with the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, and they needed to have received donations or democracy vouchers from at least 1,000 donors. Sixkiller didn't meet that standard. Now, I also watched videos of candidate statements made to the nonprofit group Choose 180, which works to keep youth out of the criminal justice system. They sent a single question to the candidates, which was, would you divest funds from the oppressive law enforcement and criminal juvenile legal systems in order to invest in community solutions and rehabilitation programs that benefit youth and young adults? Why or why not? And in what ways do you expect to be held accountable by your constituents? So that was the one question they sent out to the mayoral candidates. So I looked at all of the two to three minute video statements that the candidates gave for that question. I also looked at the candidates' websites for their policy statements on police accountability and community-based justice. So I'll take them this week in reverse alphabetical order, starting with Casey Sixkiller. Sixkiller, and I had to just look at his website because he was not in the forum, he lists among his priorities community safety that works for all of us, right? He acknowledges that people of color don't feel safe in the presence of Seattle police and that the city needs to, quote, make changes to shift the approach and culture of policing in Seattle to be community-based and community-informed and more accountable, end quote.
You know, in the decades that we have been doing this show, I don't think I have ever used the word pablum before.
It right.
It's like a good time.
Right. So he cites a lot of programs that the city council and the mayor and the current city government is already doing, moving 911 calls out of the police department, expanding the Health One program, which is managed by the fire department, expanding civilian community service officers, scaling up nonprofit community safety programs, et cetera, et cetera. So far,
a lot
so
of that
big.
Was city council's work.
Yes, indeed. And he cites diversion programs, something the city council and the city's attorney's office are hard at work on, but that the mayor's office has resisted in the past. Then he goes on to talk about how the city shouldn't cut the number of police officers too much, but should right-size the force. Whatever he means by that. To change the culture of the Seattle Police Department, he mentions reforming hiring practices, reforming training requirements, and focusing on transparency and accountability, which is all very vague, right?
And I've heard all those things before.
Yeah, and yeah. He makes no mention of the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract, the youth jail, or the participatory budgeting process. So the big impression, of course, that you get from looking at his website is business as usual under the Durkin administration. Okay, so that sums up his positions. Andrew Grant Houston supports defunding the SPD by 50%. He comes out and he's said that often. He also would decriminalize crimes of poverty like trespassing, petty theft, drug use, and sex work, which he says burdens the city with almost $100 million per year in overtime charges, court costs, jail costs, prosecution expenses, and public defender fees. I don't know if that amount is true, but he thinks that it's about $100 million. He says that that money could be better spent on restorative justice and poverty reduction programs. These programs would include $40 million for participatory budgeting per year and $42 million for a universal basic income pilot program, at least in the first year, among other smaller programs. So his public safety program boils down to defund the police by 50% and focus that money on harm reduction and anti-poverty programs. That sums up his position. Now, during the gun violence forum, Houston said that the best way to address gun violence is to redesign our systems. That's a phrase that is becoming his political focus and his political slogan, redesign the system. He would focus on providing affordable housing, food programs, healthcare, minimum wage, a universal basic income pilot program, and other anti-poverty programs to break the cycle of violence through a harm reduction and preventative approach.
Incidentally, the phrase redesign comes from the fact that his background is as an architect.
Is as an architect and an urban planner, yeah. He would not work on local gun safety laws, the only candidate who said he was not interested in doing local gun safety laws, but he would push instead for laws at the state and federal levels so that you wouldn't have people driving out of Seattle to, say, Everett or Renton, for example, to buy guns and ammunition they can't buy in Seattle. He sees that as not a workable solution. In answering Choose 180's question, he said he would expand the city's current youth diversion programs like Choose 180 and would respond to the community by defunding the SPD by 50%. So that's his focus. Bruce Harrell, on the opposite end of the spectrum, again, his focus is on using data mining to figure out, quote, how Seattle can address institutional and historical racism, end quote. Now, it's a big jump from seeing trends in the numbers to knowing what the answers are to change those trends, right? He does not address how he would come to any solutions after looking at the numbers. He just is always focused on the numbers, right? He would reform training techniques and recruiting policies within the SPD and would make every SPD officer watch the video of George Floyd's murder and sign a pledge. And the pledge would read, "The inhumane treatment of fellow human beings will not be tolerated in Seattle."
Okay. Oh, my eyes, they're rolling.
And he's gotten a lot of guff from people for that being his one policy. Yeah, and that's his one policy. Although finally he said he would, quote, "move beyond arbitrary and divisive public safety budget debates," end quote, which I understand to mean that he's not for defunding the SPD at all. Okay, so his policy really boils down to minor changes in the SPD and lots of data. Lots of studies.
SPD's budget roughly doubled during his 10 years on city council.
Yeah, and he's fine with that.
I suspect we could expect more of the same.
Yeah. Now, on reducing gun violence, he would add a cabinet-level position at the mayor's office to coordinate gun violence prevention programs. He would also gather more data, lots of data, and do lots of outreach. Now, when he was asked about the 2018 SPOG contract that passed the city council when he was president of the city council, Harrell was alarmingly incoherent. But it appears he thought that the 2018 contract was really good. Not perfect, but really, really good. And he got everything he wanted included in it. Okay, so that shows you where he's coming from. He did pledge, however, to work harder
even though on the next contract. Even though it did not include most of the reforms that were passed by the city council he was on in 2017.
There were some key reforms it didn't include. Okay, so that takes me to the next candidate, Lorena Gonzalez. Now, Gonzalez lists on her website under her economic policy the following statement. She would work with community-led efforts to shift funding from SPD to investments that will heal communities from local safety to food security to culturally responsive mental health, end quote. And that's the only statement on her website about the Seattle Police Department.
Who edits these statements?
I know. It looks like a footnote to her big economic plan. But her economic plan, I should point out, is a very big anti-poverty economic justice platform. And essentially in that statement and in her statements at the forum, she's pledging to continue the work that began under her term as city council president on the participatory budgeting process. She's actually making a more radical statement than someone with more words in their public safety platform, like Bruce Harrell, for example. But I should point out, she's not pledging to defund the SPD by 50%, like Andrew Grant Houston is. Her policy really boils down to protect the city council's current efforts to gradually defund SPD and fund community-based justice programs. Essentially, if you like what the city council has been doing and the pace that they've been doing it at, she would be a continuation of that. Now, during the forum on gun violence, she discussed the laws she helped pass as a city council member, including safe storage of firearms, allocating money for research to find the right public health solutions to gun violence, and more funding for a domestic violence unit, and then moving it from the SPD into the city attorney's office. She would increase penalties for people who lose their firearms when those guns are used in a crime. When it was her turn to answer the question about the 2018 SPOG contract, because of course she was chair of the council's public safety committee at the time that the contract was approved by the council and signed, she explained her support for the contract so much better than Harrell did and said that she was aware at the time that there were three key items missing from the contract, the subpoena power for the OIG and the OPA, removing the arbitration option for officers who are accused of excessive use of force, and extending the 180-day timeline for investigating complaints. She then pushed at that time to have the city attorney put those concerns before Judge Robart, who essentially agreed with her concerns. She said that she is currently working on the new contract and wants to be in a stronger position to get it right as mayor. Now, whether or not you agree with how she characterizes her role in all of this, especially with the 2018 contract, she explained it way better than Bruce Harrell did. So I think she deserves some points for that.
Yeah, she was at least lucid.
Yeah, she was at least lucid. And she was aware that the SPOG contract is not perfect and didn't sit there and say, I'm fine with it. Okay. Now, Jessen Farrell, she also talks about right-sizing the SPD, but she discusses it in terms of diverting funds from the SPD to stand up more mental health care workers, like the Fire Department's Health One program. She would focus on SPD detectives on investigating property crimes in certain quote-unquote hotspots, but didn't say what she thought those hotspots were.
Well, that's where Bruce Harrell's data comes in.
Yes.
Because SPD uses crime data like that to target particular neighborhoods for more patrols, et cetera. And of course, a lot of neighborhood critics have claimed that, you know, given the racist nature of arrests in the judicial system, this is a feedback loop, right? Where it's almost a tautology where you wind up targeting poor communities of color.
Which is why I wanted to hear what she meant by hot spots, but she didn't.
Yes.
She doesn't explain what that is, but because she could also be responding to complaints that the SPD doesn't pursue property crimes enough downtown where there's a lot of petty theft.
Yes. Basically what Bruce Harrell is talking about by data.
Yeah, exactly. Now, she would decriminalize minor crimes like jaywalking, bike helmet violations, and drug possession, but not drug distribution or selling. And the folks who are often prosecuted for those crimes tend to be people of color. Unlike many of the other candidates, her website mentions the 2018 SPOG contract, and she pledges to make sure the new contract will include all elements of the police reform law that the council passed in 2017. And then she would push to get the city out from under court oversight, which she says is hampering the city's ability to make important changes within the SPD, like eliminating some units that are no longer necessary or maybe were not necessary to begin with. She is a big supporter of diversion programs, having served on the board of Community Passageways, and she pledges to fund more diversion and drug treatment programs. Her policy boils down to the city could do a lot better at public safety reform, and it's really hard to argue with that, right? But we should note, she also did not pledge to defund the SPD by 50%. Now, during the forum, the gun violence forum, she said she would treat the gun violence epidemic with the same amount of resources that the city has used to address COVID-19, including a dashboard at the city. She supports universal background checks and would work with regional, state, and federal governments to strengthen gun safety laws and enforce the ones on the books. She would also create an office of gun violence prevention at the city level. She acknowledged that young people are leading on this issue nationally, the only candidate who said that, and said that as mayor, she would encourage adults, especially white adults, to get off the sidelines and get involved. In her video response to Choose 180's question, she said, quote, no young person should be in a cage, end quote. The only candidate who said that, right? She pledged to divest in criminal justice programs that harm young people and invest in restorative justice and mental health treatment programs. In addition, she would prioritize anti-poverty programs and end the school-to-prison pipeline.
That's the closest I've heard to acknowledging what is true both locally and nationally, for that matter.
Yeah.
That communities of color are already way, way in the lead on this issue and doing a lot more work on this than the city level administrators are doing.
Yeah. So of all the candidates, Jessen Farrell, I think, did the very best in terms of gun violence, maybe not the best in terms of police accountability, but definitely in terms of gun violence and restorative justice. And that I put down to her being a board member of Community Passageways and really knowing the issue. And when she knows the issue, she does really well in talking, in framing the solutions and in talking about them. So of all the candidates, she did really well, I think, in the forum. Now, that brings me to Colleen Echohawk, right? Her website lists three priorities for public safety, and they're very easily summed up as 1, a new chief, 2, a new contract, and 3, a new culture. She's pledging to involve communities in helping to select a new police chief, but be aware, she led the selection process that ended with Carmen Best as the SPD chief. Okay. Now, she's pledging to negotiate a new SPOG union contract that is, quote, equitable and fair, following best practice labor and workplace standards, end quote. And you could argue that that is exactly the problem with the last contract. Seattle really needs to take a lead on reforms beyond what other police departments have done around the nation. But Echo Hawk apparently doesn't think so. Okay.
How do you create a new culture without firing everybody in the current SPD?
Well, she says that she will revisit the city's accountability. Oh, here's the other thing. She also said that she would, quote, revisit the city's accountability ordinance, ensuring that it is in compliance with the new contract and statewide reforms, end quote. In other words, she wants to do it all backwards instead of ensuring that the new SPOG contract matches what the city council passed in 2017. She would reopen that law and change it to match whatever new contract she negotiates, which is bad news, right? As for culture, to answer your question, Job, she would hire more officers who live inside the city of Seattle and encourage a more diverse pool of new recruits, which, you know, is what the Seattle Police Department is already doing. In addition, she would require diversity training and trauma-informed training for, quote, all judges, prosecutors, defenders, and clerks as a way to change SPD culture, which makes no freaking sense, right? And of course, the list goes on and on. She has a really long list of things on her website related to Seattle, to public safety, and a whole lot of them don't make any sense at all. Her policies really boil down to she understands there's a problem, and she has lots and lots of little flaky solutions that don't make any sense. Okay.
Now, Seattle is already trying to recruit a more diverse police force, and they're having trouble recruiting.
Yeah.
We know this already.
Yeah,
and even if you change the new recruits coming in, that doesn't change the existing culture. Mm-hmm. Because the new recruits come in, and who do they get trained by? The people in the existing culture.
Right, right. So like I say, she has a lot of
training will solve everything.
Oh, yeah. She has lots of little flaky solutions that don't make a whole lot of sense. And in some cases, like her idea of revisiting the city's accountability ordinance could be actively harmful and roll back reforms already in place. Now, in addition, during the forum, she was highly emotional, even more so than in other forums where I've seen her. She mentioned that the topic of gun violence was triggering for her. And when asked what she would do differently from Mayor Durkin, she said, quote, I'll be honest, I sucked up to power. And I will do it again to do things that no one has been able to do for my community, right? Which, you know, leaving aside the fact that she thinks of herself as the savior of Native American people in Seattle, there are always trade-offs to sucking up to power, okay? And by not acknowledging that, she's just proving that she doesn't have the maturity and intelligence to do the job, you know?
And I wonder about her toughness also, honestly.
Oh, I do.
I mean, if she gets triggered by discussions of, say, gun violence, how
policy
she stand up to SPD?
Yeah, policy discussions of gun violence. Yeah. So in her video responding to the question from Choose 180, she reiterates the need for a new SPOG contract and a new police chief, although that's not what the question was about. In addition, she says she'll create a Department of Public Safety at the city level. Okay. I just want to mention to her, Colleen Echo Hawk, if you're listening to this, honey, there's already a Department of Public Safety at the city level. That's what the fire and police departments are.
I was going to say.
That's currently what the police department is. Now, she clearly doesn't know much about how city government functions. She doesn't have great ideas. She's not doesn't appear to be emotionally stable. She doesn't have good solutions. So I'm actually a little frightened when I see her.
But other than that, she's awesome.
Yeah. So I have to say, of all the candidate statements on this issue, these issues, Jessen Farrell's was surprisingly good and went way up in my estimation after watching some of these. She knows these issues when she knows an issue, she can really frame it well, provide some good specific solutions. And she loses the mom voice, which I think is very helpful. Andrew Grant Houston is the candidate if you want big structural change and a promise to defund the SPD by 50%. Gonzalez is the candidate for you if you think the city council is headed in the right direction and they just need some more time and need to take the time to get it right. If you support Jenny Durkin's policies, Casey Sixkiller is your candidate. If you want to go back to the Norm Rice era, back when activists of my generation were working really hard to replace members of the city council because we recognized that it only responded to the downtown business community, then Bruce Harrell is your guy. I just do not recommend voting for Colleen Echohawk at all. I would not want her to stick her fingers into this issue at all. And I'm actually a little frightened after watching her response to some of these questions on public safety.
Yeah, so not to give away too much of next week, but my basic thinking right now is that of the top six candidates, they basically split into groups of three.
Yeah.
In terms of who's progressive and who's not.
Yeah, I agree.
That you've got, Andrew Grant Houston and Lorena Gonzalez and Jessen Farrell at the top, and then you've got the others.
Yeah, and next week we'll debate which of those three we think would be the most progressive.
Or the most appropriate. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of laid it out. We'll talk about if we were voting for the most progressive candidate, who we think that person would be.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Now, I also this week looked at some of the recorded forums for the council position number 9 with Nikita Oliver, Sarah Nelson, and Brianna Thomas. And I was kind of pleased to note that Nikita Oliver looks a lot more mature. And she's reminding me a little bit of Andrew Grant Houston because Nikita goes by they, them pronouns in their ability to look at the way the city is doing business and suggest a major structural change. So I think Oliver has more maturity and a lot more understanding of city politics this time around than they did when they were running for mayor in the last mayor.
That was back in 2017, yeah.
Yeah, so it's been a few years. Oliver has a lot more experience under their belt running a larger organization and looking at major issues at the city level. And I was really impressed by Oliver's answers. That said, I was also impressed by Brianna Thomas and her answers to her questions. She kind of reminded me of Gonzalez in her ability to look at the very kind of wonky ins and outs of how policy is made at the city council level. So voting for Thomas, you would get someone with a lot of experience and knowledge of how the city council functions. Voting for Oliver, you'd get a lot of an emphasis on some major change and change that would they would want to happen rapidly.
And voting for Sarah Nelson, you'd get whatever Jeff Bezos.
You'd get a dilettante, essentially. That was my impression of Sarah Nelson, is that if you want to go back to that city council under Mayor Norm Rice, the city council that included people like Gene Godden, then vote for Sarah Nelson.
She's a former legislative aide to Richard Conlon. So,
She's not as good as Conlon. She really does remind me of Gene Godden, more sort of let's sit on the city council because it's a prestige thing and it's a social thing.
Yeah.
I was kind of shocked at how under par Sarah Nelson is as a candidate. I expected her to be a little more on top of things. So it would be interesting to see Oliver and Thomas make it through the primary, and that's what I would hope for, because then it would be a tough choice, I think, come November.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about those candidates more next week.
All right. Because ballots are going out soon.
Yep. They're coming. Santa's making a list.
Yes.
All right. Let's move on. And this week, more reports and analysis coming out about the devastating effects of the most recent heat wave here in the West Coast and Pacific Northwest.
Actually, it's no longer the most recent on the West Coast. There's one in the Southwest right now. It's supposed to be 130 in Death Valley today, but I digress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the June heat wave, which reached an all-time high of 121 degrees in British Columbia, and health officials are saying that hundreds of people were killed, including 116 in Oregon, 78 people in Washington State, and 719 people in British Columbia. 719 people. But people were not the only ones who were suffering from heat stress during the heat wave. Marine biologists are saying that shellfish were literally cooked alive in their shells all up and down the West Coast as temperatures on shoreline rocks reached up to 122 degrees. Marine biologists are estimating now that up to 1 billion shellfish were killed during the heat wave.
That's billion with a B.
Yeah.
And it's not just shellfish. It's also sea stars and a bunch of other marine salmon, a bunch of other marine animals.
Yeah, and the worry is that salmon are returning to their home streams earlier and earlier every year because it's getting warmer and warmer earlier every year, and that they could if we have another one of these a little bit later in the summer, it could kill a major number of salmon. Now, shellfish, the loss of shellfish is not a minor thing because they're a keystone of the marine ecology. They filter, for one thing, they filter water and they keep it clean. In addition, they are a major source of food for a lot of marine mammals and for a lot of shorebirds. And marine mammals and shorebirds are already stressed by climate change and loss of habitat. So losing a keystone of shoreline ecology is a major problem. And an event that wipes out a large number of shellfish is literally a disastrous event. Now, it takes 2 or 3 years for a lot of shellfish to reach maturity and to come back. So even when you have oyster farms and shellfish farms reseeding their beds, it's going to take a couple years to restore those. So
and in a couple of years, we might have another heat wave like that.
Oh, we might have another one later this year, too.
Yeah. And we also saw a report from International Climatology Society saying that with almost 100% certainty, the Pacific Northwest heat wave was caused by climate change. Yeah. You know, no surprise, but it does help to have it confirmed at that level. And, you know, we are continuing to see other events of climate change also. Hurricane Elsa, one of the earliest hurricanes to make Atlantic landfall in late June, early July. We had, as I mentioned, the heat wave going on right now in the desert southwest. Several countries in Central Asia have had record temperatures this past couple days, like for the entire country. Because of a heat wave going on there. So we're seeing this over and over. June was the hottest month on record. Hottest June on record, I should say. So, you know, it's just continuing to accelerate. And you know, it's like, at what point does this become an emergency? Mm-hmm. You would think about 20 years ago, but, you know, that didn't happen.
Well, I'm sure they'll let us know when they think it's an emergency.
Yeah.
We should consult big business to see what they
Well, think. You know, the biggest business seem to be trying to escape into outer space, which, you know,
which, just, good luck. I'm hoping that they'll realize at some point that, oh gosh, we have something valuable back on planet Earth, a planet that actually supports life.
Yes.
All right. We got just 10 minutes left. So,
all right. Let's move on.
Touch on any significant developments with the pandemic this week.
I would say let's skip that. We're seeing a major outbreak in Arkansas and Missouri with the Delta variant, which is now over 50% of all infections in the United States. It's a bad news. Don't think pandemic is over because it's not.
Next. Yeah, and we are hearing from the CDC and other health departments that it is okay to continue to wear a mask and that it's highly effective. So that's a reminder that really they probably lifted the mask mandate too soon.
Yes, although they're also issued a school reopening guidance yesterday that is heavily weighted towards school as normal, which is a little concerning. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we should move on.
Updates on the condominium collapse in Florida.
Yeah, we found out this week that law enforcement had routinely ignored complaints that inspections were skipped at the Champlain Towers condominium. The death toll is now up to 78 officially, with some 62 still missing. And you know, they're still poking through the rubble there. The companion building was demolished this past week, which is probably a blessing, but it does leave a bunch more people homeless. So that tragedy is reverberating, I think, in building codes around the country. And also, you know, speaking of climate change, very likely that climate change had a lot to do with that collapse on a barrier island.
Okay, and updates on the Trump organization.
The Trump crime family? There were a bunch of Trump-related developments this week. We found out that it wasn't just Georgia where Donald Trump pressured election officials to overturn the result. He also did that in Arizona. And now the Arizona Secretary of State has come out calling for a criminal investigation similar to the one that's already underway in Georgia as to whether Trump violated criminal law in pressuring election officials to overturn the result. So keep your eye on that. Rudy Giuliani was disbarred in the District of Columbia this week to go along with his failure to be able to practice law in New York State. Now he can't practice in D.C. either, which takes away a lot of his lobbying work. And we have an interesting development in Michigan, where the state attorney general there has launched a criminal investigation for fraud of people who've been pushing the idea that Donald Trump somehow won the state of Michigan, even though Biden was declared the official victor by 150,000 votes and the state Republican Party, or the Republican-controlled legislature, issued a report saying they found no evidence of election fraud. But so the Attorney General of Michigan is saying, you know, there are an awful lot of people doing an awful lot of fundraising off of these fraud claims. Isn't that illegal? So they've launched a criminal investigation of that. Also, keep your eye out on Monday, a state judge in Michigan who had dismissed one of the frivolous Trump election fraud lawsuits back in December, has asked all of Trump's different lawyers, Sidney Powell and a bunch of lesser names you probably don't want to know, to appear in court to explain why they should not face court-related sanctions for essentially lying about election fraud. Now, that could include referral for disbarment. It could include all sorts of different things. It could include, you know, different court sanctions. So that's going to be happening Monday morning. So keep your eye on that coming up also. Let's talk about Haiti.
Yeah, finally there was assassination in Haiti. Sweet.
Yeah, Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated on, I believe it was very, very early on Wednesday morning, late Tuesday night, early Wednesday morning. A total of 28 men took part in the assassination. At least two of them were American, Haitian Americans, James Solage and Vincent Joseph.
I have seen interviews with Haitians who are extremely skeptical of the official police narrative of that assassination, including that it was foreign nationals who were involved. So I would put allegedly before that, right? Now,
yeah. Until we know more. They say that they have captured about 15 Colombian nationals involved in the assassination. Now, Solage, what we know about him is that he had weapons and security training from a private security school in Florida. And about a decade ago, he had worked for a company that contracted to provide security for the Canadian embassy in Haiti. He has also worked as a building maintenance man in South Florida, although it's not clear whether that was just a cover. He also ran a small charity that provided developmental money for the port city of Jacmel in Haiti. And he was known to travel frequently from Fort Lauderdale, Florida to Jacmel and back. He has described himself at various times as a budding politician, a corporate executive, and a quote-unquote certified diplomatic agent.
According to the police narrative, the Americans were there as translators. They did not actually participate in the assassination.
Yeah,
and 13 of those 15 Colombians are former Colombian military.
Yeah, but there are also some Haitian citizens who are saying now on social media that Solage used to work as a security guard for two of President Moïse's opponents, Reginald Bulos and Dimitri Vorbe. Moïse, of course, was under pressure from his opponents to step down, given that his five-year term had ended early last year. Recent large protests by the opposition have been demanding that Moïse step down. Haiti hasn't had a functioning parliament since January 2020, when the president should have called new elections, but didn't. In the meantime, gangs have been running the neighborhoods of Haiti's largest cities. Inflation has taken hold of the economy, and COVID-19 is surging out of control. Little is known about the other American, Vincent Joseph, except that he's 56 years old and apparently has been living in Miami. Like many people his age, he has very little social media presence. Now, the Washington Post cited a source close to the investigation who said that Joseph had been in Haiti for 6 months and that, as Jav mentioned, Joseph and Solage were working as translators for the Colombians, who were plotting to arrest President Moïse, not to kill him. But Moïse was shot 12 times, his wife was shot 3 times, and his home was ransacked by the assailants. Meanwhile, the Colombian government has confirmed that at least a few of the men involved in the attack are former members of the Colombian army. So the question is, are all the assailants Colombians, other than Moïse and Joseph, other than Solage and Joseph? It's known that Moïse had many enemies among the political opposition and business interests in Haiti who opposed his efforts to nationalize parts of the Haitian energy sector. He also has been accused of supporting and working with criminal gangs in Haiti, although he has recently denied any connection. And it's not uncommon, of course, for the CIA and the U.S. military to intervene in Haitian politics. That's been a U.S. pastime for centuries.
Yeah, and we've talked about such interventions at least twice in the history of this show.
Yeah.
So that tells you how often it happens. Yeah.
Yeah. So keep your eye on that, and I'm sure there will be more news released about.
Yes. Haiti has asked for the U.S. to send military forces to stabilize the country. Mm-hmm. We haven't gotten a response from the Biden administration to that yet, but I'm expecting something this weekend.
And there's confusion right now over who's actually running the Haitian government, since the man who stepped forward and declared himself interim president actually is not the person that Moïse had picked to serve as interim president when he was planning to step down in a few weeks. So there's that struggle going on as well.
Yeah, and as you mentioned that COVID is particularly bad in Haiti right now. Haiti has not received any vaccine yet at all. So that's another aspect to this crisis that is creating sort of a perfect storm of humanitarian crisis.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we're out of time. So we will have to continue this again this same time next week.
We okay. will. And we'll talk about the ballot.
And yep. we will talk about the election.
Yep. Woohoo.